Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Isaiah chapter 30, which I will entitle, Do Not Go Down to Egypt. Now, as a little bit of background, the majority opinion amongst the commentators is that this is referring to the situation when King Sennacherib of Hezekiah was bearing down on Judah, had taken almost every city in Judah, and had besieged Jerusalem in 701. And that's the way I'm going to take it. So we start now in chapter 30, verses 1 through 5. Woe to the obstinate children, declares the Lord, to those who carry out plans that are not mine, forming an alliance, but not by my spirit, heaping sin upon sin, who go down to Egypt without consulting me, who look for help to Pharaoh's protection, to Egypt's shade for refuge. But Pharaoh's protection will be to your shame. Egypt's shade will bring you disgrace. Though they have officials in Zoan, and their envoys have arrived in Hanes, everyone will be put to shame because of a people useless to them, who bring neither help nor advantage, but only shame and disgrace. Now in verse 1, Isaiah says, Woe to the obstinate children. He doesn't mention Hezekiah by name, and that's sort of strange. Isaiah does mention Ahaz in chapter 7. He mentions Hezekiah by name in chapter 39, but not here. Gary Smith says that the reason could be is that Hezekiah is not the driving force behind the desire for the Egyptian alliance, but rather his advisors. Could be. Now, these advisors are people, these children, these obstinate children who don't listen to their parent, Yahweh, to those who carry out plans that are not mine, forming an alliance. It was not in God's mind that Israel would form an alliance with Egypt. Now, looking at it from a military point of view or a strategic point of view, an alliance with Egypt might make sense because Egypt is on the southwest of Israel and Assyria is on the northeast of Israel as they come across the Euphrates River and come down on Judah. Judah's right in the middle. And so the nation of Judah, as well as the other small nations around there, Syria, the Philistines, the Tyrians, the Sidonians, it would make sense for them to try to get Egypt on their side as a big nation in order to try to stop the Assyrians coming from the other direction. And so it logically made sense, but God didn't want them, the Judahites, to enter into such an alliance. Now in verse 1, Isaiah says, or God says through Isaiah, Yahweh says, Listen, it's not by my spirit that you're going down there to Egypt. You're heaping sin upon sin, those of you who go down to Egypt without consulting me, who look for help to Pharaoh's protection, to Egypt's shade for refuge. The Assyrian sun is getting hot. You want to go down to Egypt to get in the shade? It's not going to do any good. Verse 3, Pharaoh's protection will be to your shame. Egypt's shade will bring you disgrace. Now, here are a couple of options as how an attempted alliance with Egypt might bring Israel disgrace. Option number 1, Judah would be ashamed, disgraced, because the Egyptians refused the alliance. Option number 2, Egypt would agree to the alliance, but then Egypt would be unable to defend Judah from Assyria. Now, to my knowledge, Hezekiah never made that alliance with Egypt, but he wanted to. And if it had gone through, it wouldn't have made any difference because Assyria would have won. It was going to take God's supernatural power to get rid of the Assyrians. 701, when the plague hit Sennacherib's army, when they were besieging Jerusalem, and they all had to flee back to Assyria. Now, let me read you a quotation from Adam Clark concerning this chapter. Images the most elegant and lofty by which the intense gloriousness of Messiah's reign at the period when all Israel shall be added to the church is beautifully set forth in verses 18 through 26. So Clark wants to add to the story of Sennacherib and the Assyrians, he wants to add some messianic stuff at the end. We'll look at that. That's controversial. People disagree on that. Clark continues, Dreadful fall of Sennacherib's army, an event most manifestly typical of the terrible and sudden overthrow of Antichrist. And who might that be? I don't know. Who's the Antichrist? Capital A Antichrist. There's no such Antichrist in the Bible. There are Antichrist. There's the beast, but that's not the Antichrist. It doesn't say he's the Antichrist. Clark continues, Unless this typical reference be admitted, the sudden overthrow of the Antichrist, no possible connection can be imagined between the stupendous events which took place in Hezekiah's reign and the very remote and inconceivably more glorious displays of divine vengeance and mercy in the days of the Messiah. And that's in verses 27 through 33. So Clark says we start out with Sennacherib and the Assyrians, and we end up with the overthrow of some Antichrist. in verses 18 through 26, and then in verses 27 through 33, we end up in the days of Messiah. I think that is entirely overblown and produced by a man who's got too much time on his hands. Now let's see what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say. The 30th through 32nd chapters of Isaiah refer probably to the summer of 714 B.C., as the 29th chapter refers to the Passover of that year. Jewish ambassadors were now on their way to Egypt to seek aid against Assyria. Isaiah denounces this reliance on Egypt rather than on Yahweh. God had prohibited such alliances with heathen nations, and it was a leading part of Jewish polity that they should be a separate people. Now, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown refers to a period before Sennacherib came in. Sennacherib started his reign in 705, and sometime between 705 and 701, he came into Judah, started wiping out every city in sight. And so before that time is when Hezekiah would be tempted to go down to Egypt to make an alliance. Now, this denunciation of a potential alliance with a heathen nation is just an extension of the long-standing divine policy and law against such pagan alliances. We read in the law in Exodus 23:32, you must not make a covenant with them or their gods. Well, if you make a covenant with Egypt, you're making a covenant with the pagans, Deuteronomy 7:2. And when the Lord your God delivers them over to you and you defeat them, you must completely destroy them, make no treaty with them, and show them no mercy. So no treaty with the Canaanites when you're destroying them. Egypt is not mentioned, but the idea is the same. You don't make treaties with pagan nations. If you think about it, remember when Ahaz made a treaty with Assyria to beat Pekah and Rezin of Syria and Pekah of the northern nation of Israel that were allied together against Ahaz? That didn't turn out so well. Assyria, after knocking out Pekah and Rezin, eventually Assyria came down and attacked Ahaz's son Hezekiah. That didn't work out well. And who was it that made the alliance with Merodach-Baladan? I think that was Hezekiah also. It was. In Isaiah 39, we read the story. Merodach-Baladan was a king of the rebellious province of Babylonia, rebelling against King Sargon II of Assyria. And Hezekiah was tempted to enter into an alliance with him, because if you take the Babylonian province and Elam and Syria and these other nations that were opposed to the great Assyrian Empire, it might have made sense to have a rebellious Babylonian province of the Assyrian Empire on your side. But Hezekiah showed Merodach-Baladan all of his wealth, and Isaiah says, all this is going to be taken off to Babylon. When Babylon gets to be the big dog in the Middle East, that alliance didn't work out so well. So I think we see that as a general rule, Israel would have been much better off to avoid pagan alliances, just like God wanted them to do, and to trust in him alone. Now, in verse 2, Isaiah says, by quoting Yahweh, that Yahweh was upset with those who go down to Egypt without consulting Yahweh. Well, when was this? I've been assuming it's during the time of Sennacherib. Benson, Jameson, Fawcett, Brown, Clark, and the pulpit commentary agree with that. However, the history written in 2 Kings 18 does not explicitly say that Hezekiah had asked Egypt for aid, as the pulpit commentary points out, but the pulpit commentary also says that the reproaches of Rabshakeh cited in that historical passage, those reproaches would be pointless if Hezekiah had not asked for aid from Egypt. We read in 2 Kings 18:21, look, you are now trusting in Egypt, that splintered reed of a staff that will enter and pierce the hand of anyone who leans on it. This is how Pharaoh, king of Egypt, is to all who trust in him. How then can you drive back a single officer among the least of my master's servants and trust in Egypt for chariots and horsemen? So Egypt's mentioned three times in those three verses. Look, you are now trusting in Egypt, and Pharaoh, king of Egypt, will be like a splintered reed. And why should you trust in Egypt for chariots and for horsemen? Obviously, the Rabshakeh, the Assyrian official who's saying this, why are you people of Judah trusting in Egypt? So obviously Hezekiah was thinking about an alliance with Egypt. Isaiah, also in Isaiah 25 through 6, had inveighed against Judah making an alliance with Egypt. I assume it's the same time in this period between Sargon II, 722, Sennacherib, 705. In this period, Hezekiah is looking for some help. We read in Isaiah 25 and 6, those who made Cush their hope, now Cush is Ethiopia, and the Ethiopians had taken over the throne of Egypt at this time. So when you see Cush, it's the same thing as Egypt. It was an Ethiopian pharaoh at the time. Those who made Cush their hope and Egypt their boast will be dismayed and ashamed. And the inhabitants of this coastland will say on that day, look, this is what has happened to those who relied on and fled for help to rescue us from the king of Assyria. Now, how will we escape? So let's get some background on what's going on in Judah in the run-up to the siege of Jerusalem in 701. First of all, we have Sargon II, who, after taking over the siege of Samaria, northern Israel, in 722 and deporting a bunch of northern Israelites, he ruled down to 705, and then his father, Sennacherib, took over in 705. So this is what Ellicott says. The occasion of the campaign is related by Sargon in the annals just mentioned as happening in his 11th year, so that'll be somewhere around 710 or so. Assuri, the king of Ashdod, refused to pay tribute and revolted. Revolted from Assyria, Sargon deposed him and placed his brother Akhismet on the throne. The people in their turn rose against Akhismet and chose Yaman as their king. Sargon then marched against the city, took it, and carried off its gods and its treasures as booty. These events naturally excited the minds of Hezekiah and his counselors and led them to look to an alliance with Egypt as their best protection. Now, Hezekiah did not make an alliance with Egypt because of the Assyrian raid on Ashdod. Ashdod is a Philistine city on the coast of the Mediterranean to Jerusalem south and west. And naturally, that would be concerning to Hezekiah, but he didn't make that alliance. Now, the pulpit commentary says that all during this period, right before Sennacherib took over in 705, when Assyria was ruled by Sargon II, probably from B.C. 713 to B.C. 711, or during the whole of the time that Philistia, Edom, Moab, and Judah were making representations to the Egyptians and Ethiopians and endeavoring to obtain their aid. And that makes sense. That's a reasonable speculation. So geopolitically, it made a lot of sense for Hezekiah to look for Egypt's aid. And Hezekiah, speaking truth to power, says, no, don't do that. Now, there are some other opinions as to when chapter 30 took place. I consider them minority opinions. For example, some people say that these ambassadors going down to get help from Egypt took place during the times of Shalmaneser V. He ruled from 727 to 722, right before Sargon II. We read in 2 Kings 17:4 that Hoshea, the last king of Israel who got wiped out by Shalmaneser V and Sargon II in 722, we read in 2 Kings 17:4, but the king of Assyria discovered Hoshea's conspiracy. Hoshea had sent envoys to So, king of Egypt, and had not paid tribute money to the king of Assyria as in previous years. Therefore, the king of Assyria arrested him and put him in prison. So Hoshea had actually gone down to the pharaoh, called So here in 2 Kings 17, and had tried to make an alliance with him. Most people don't think that's when Israel was looking for help from Egypt, although they were at the time. But Hezekiah is talking to the southern people of Israel, of Judah, I think. Some people say that the strictures against allying with Egypt took place in the times of Jeremiah. We read in Jeremiah 41:17, they, that's the remnant of the Judahites left in Israel, left in Judah after the destruction of the city of Jerusalem by the Babylonians in 586 BC, this remnant, these survivors left in order to make their way into Egypt. So you see, the Israelites were constantly looking for help to protect themselves from Babylonia and Assyria, and they looked to Egypt for that help. Some people say that the looking to Egypt took place in the times of Zedekiah, the last king of Judah. Remember Zedekiah, I think that was 597 BC, if I remember correctly. He tried to get some help from the Egyptians, and the Babylonians says, no, no, no. And they came in and they took him off into captivity to Babylon. Some people say it was in the times of Ahaz before Hezekiah, but there's no account of him sending to Egypt for help, so we'll throw that one out. Those are just some other opinions. I think the majority opinion is this happened all right around the time that Sennacherib came into Judah in 705 or so and surrounded Jerusalem in 701 B.C. Now in verse 4, Isaiah says, though they have officials in Zoan, and actually this is Yahweh speaking through Isaiah, though they have officials in Zoan, that's Jewish officials, diplomats going down to Zoan, famous city in Egypt, and their envoys have arrived in Hanes, or Hanes, H-A-N-E-S, sounds like underwear, Hanes underwear. Though they have officials in Zoan and their envoys have arrived in Hanes, looking for that alliance, if you look at a map of Egypt, you will see Zoan right before you get to the Mediterranean Sea on one of the branches of the Nile River as those branches spread out through the Nile Delta. And Hanes is not shown on the map as Hanes, but as Tahpanhes, T-A-H-P-A-N-H-E-S. It's about 20 miles to the east of Zoan. These were the two major cities in Egypt at that time, right near the land of Goshen on the way to the Shur Desert, which is that desert which separates Israel from Egypt, right at the southeastern corner of the Mediterranean Sea. Jeremiah actually ended up prophesying in Tahpanhes, which we'll see when we get to Jeremiah. Jeremiah chapter 43, verse 9, but we'll hold that for right now. So we see that the Jews had gone a long way toward making an alliance with Egypt, but Isaiah is screaming and hollering against that. He says everyone will be put to shame because of a people useless to them. In other words, the Israelites will be put to shame. The Judahites will be put to shame because they are useless to the Egyptians. They are a small rump kingdom that cannot stop the onslaught of the mighty Assyrian Empire, so the Egyptians are going to have nothing to do with the Jews. They are useless. They bring neither help nor advantage to the Egyptians. They only bring shame and disgrace. Shame and disgrace because they could not defeat the Assyrians. Now, actually, you could say that the time period here is talking about the destruction of the northern Israelites in 722 B.C. when Shalmaneser V started and Sargon II finished the siege of the northern kingdom of Israel's capital, Samaria. That really was a shame and a disgrace. They got wiped out and carried off, so why would Egypt want to make an alliance with them? Guzik takes it that way, but I'm going to stick with Sennacherib, and we will say that Egypt will look at Hezekiah's pitiful situation, even though Hezekiah had not actually gone down yet. But Egypt's going to say, hey, you guys are useless to us. You shame us. You disgrace us. Notice in verse 3, Egypt brought disgrace on Israel because Egypt couldn't help them. And now in verse 5, the Egyptians are rejecting the Jews because the Judahites bring shame on Egypt. The shame goes both ways. They are of no use to each other. Nobody is going to beat the Assyrians, except God Almighty, of course. We go now to Isaiah 30, verses 6 through 7. An oracle concerning the animals of the Negev, through a land of hardship and distress, of lions and lionesses, of adders and darting snakes, the envoys carry their riches on donkeys' backs, their treasures on the humps of camels, to that unprofitable nation, to Egypt, whose help is utterly useless. Therefore I call her Rahab the Do-Nothing. Now, it's unusual for a prophet to prophesy about animals, but of course that's just a poetic device. He's prophesying against the envoys who are walking through the land of those animals, these Jewish envoys who are trying to make an alliance, an unprofitable and sinful alliance with Egypt. The animals of the Negev. The Negev, of course, is that southern desert region of Israel. I've driven through it all the way from Jerusalem all the way down to the tip right next to Egypt, right there on the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, and it is a wonderful, interesting place to go through. It's one of the highlights of my life to go through there. I didn't see any lions and lionesses, adders, or snakes, but I saw a lot of other interesting stuff. At any rate, going through the Negev, the envoys, these Jewish envoys going down to Egypt, they carry their riches on donkeys' backs, their treasures on the humps of camels. That's probably to give presents, of course, to the Egyptian pharaohs to impress them. They go into that unprofitable nation, to Egypt. Now, Egypt is called Rahab, the Do-Nothing. I love that, the Do-Nothing. Rahab is a typical name for Egypt. We see in Psalms 87:4, I will mention those who know me, Rahab, Babylon, Philistia, Tyre, and Cush. Rahab is mentioned there as Egypt in Isaiah 51:9. Wake up, put on the strength of the Lord's power. Wake up as in days past, as in generations of long ago. Wasn't it you who hacked Rahab to pieces, who pierced the sea monster? So if you see Rahab, think Egypt. We go now to Isaiah 30, verses 8 through 11. Go now, write it on a tablet for them, inscribe it on a scroll, that for the days to come it may be an everlasting witness. These are rebellious people, deceitful children, children unwilling to listen to the Lord's instruction. They say to the seers, see no more visions, and to the prophets, give us no more visions of what is right. Tell us pleasant things. Prophesy illusions. Leave this way, get off this path, and stop confronting us with the Holy One of Israel. Now, these deceitful children who are being talked to have already been referred to as obstinate children in verse 1, referring to the leaders of Judah who want to make an alliance with Egypt. In verse 8, Isaiah says, write it on a tablet for them. Write what? Well, the prophecy of their destruction, for example, or it could be their sins. Write it down so they see the truth. And on that tablet, those words would be an everlasting witness against the sinful people of Judah. Note to this day that the sins of Israel and their destruction, Judah in particular, are still talked about, talking about it right now. So the rebellious people say they don't want to listen to prophets, that's true prophets. We don't want to see any more visions, which the true prophets might relate to them. Don't tell us what's right, only tell us pleasant things, such as, oh, those nice Assyrians, they will never hurt you. Let's just reach our hand across the aisle to the Assyrians, and they will lift us up and treat us kindly as their children. Isaiah says, go right ahead, prophesy illusions. And then in verse 11, he quotes the false prophets as saying, leave this way. Get off this path of confronting us with the Holy One of Israel. In other words, this way of listening to Isaiah tell us that the Holy One of Israel, Yahweh, is mad with us. We don't want to hear it anymore. In other words, get off the way of Isaiah. Get out of his path. Don't let him confront us with the words of Yahweh anymore. We don't want to hear it. We're tired of this doom and gloom. We want peace and prosperity. We go down to Isaiah 30, verses 12 through 14. Isaiah continues, therefore, this is what the Holy One of Israel says, because you have rejected this message, relied on oppression, and depended on deceit, this sin will become for you like a high wall, cracked and bulging, that collapses suddenly in an instant. It will break in pieces like pottery, shattered so mercilessly that among its pieces not a fragment will be found for taking coals from a hearth or scooping water out of a cistern. A high wall that's cracked and bulging, it reminds me of these pictures of these big dams, and they break in the middle, and the water comes rushing through, and as soon as that happens, boom, down goes the dam in an instant. Isaiah's point here is that the Jews' confidence in Egypt will also collapse in an instant. They are worthless. They are Rahab, the do-nothing. We go now to Isaiah 30, verses 15 through 17. Isaiah continues, this is what the Sovereign Lord, the Holy One of Israel, says. In repentance and rest is your salvation. In quietness and trust is your strength. But you would have none of it. You said, no, we will flee on horses. Therefore you will flee. You said, we will ride off on swift horses. Therefore your pursuers will be swift. 1,000 will flee at the threat of one. At the threat of five, you will all flee away, till you are left like a flagstaff on a mountaintop, like a banner on a hill. Well, God gives the answer. Instead of an alliance with Egypt, you need to repent, you need to rest in your salvation, you need to be quiet, you need to trust in God who is your strength. No, but you wouldn't have any of that. Instead, you want horses, because Egypt was famous for horses. You said in verse 16, we will flee, we'll get away from the Assyrians, we'll just get on an Egyptian horse and ride. That's speaking metaphorically, of course. And God says, okay, you'll flee. You'll flee, all right. You'll run like scared rabbits. And then God says, you Jews say that we will ride off on swift horses. Okay, yeah, your horses are swift, but your pursuers will be swift too. And they'll come after you, and 1,000 Jews will flee at the threat of one Assyrian. At the threat of five Assyrians, every last one of you Jews are going to flee. And pretty soon you will have no help. You will be like a lonely flagstaff on a mountaintop, like a banner on a hill. Of course, the point of that metaphor is loneliness. There won't be anybody to help you because you turned your back on God. We go now to Isaiah 30, verses 18 through 22. Yet the Lord longs to be gracious to you. He rises to show you compassion. Now here we see, after all the judgment on Judah, there's always mercy mixed in with the judgment in Isaiah's prophecies. Yet the Lord longs to be gracious to you. He rises to show you compassion, for the Lord is a God of justice. Blessed are all who wait for him. O people of Zion who live in Jerusalem, you will weep no more. How gracious he will be when you cry for help. As soon as he hears, he will answer you. Although the Lord gives you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, your teachers will be hidden no more. With your own eyes you will see them. Whether you turn to the right or to the left, your ears will hear a voice behind you saying, this is the way, walk in it. Then you will defile your idols overlaid with silver and your images covered with gold. You will throw them away like a minstrel cloth and say to them, away with you. Now the good news here starts in verse 18, the Lord longs to be gracious to you. Now when might that occur? Some people say it refers to the return from Babylon. Some people say that it refers to the return from Babylon as a type of New Testament Christians coming into the church. Adam Clark and John Gill hold to that view. Gill mentions as a possible option it refers to the return of the northern Israelites who were expelled from northern Israel in 722 by Sargon II of Assyria. Well, in my humble opinion, I believe that the Lord is gracious to Judah after he runs Sennacherib off his army away from the siege of Jerusalem in 701. That fits the context pretty good, in my opinion. Now, in verse 18, Isaiah says that God rises to show you Jews compassion because the Lord is a God of justice. Well, it seems to me that if you're talking about justice here, it would seem like God would have to just wipe Judah out. That would be justice because of all the sins of which Isaiah has been talking about in the first 17 verses. Well, this is what Benson says about this justice. The King James, by the way, has judgment. The Lord is a God of judgment. Benson says, quote, "He is wise, God, is wise and just in all the dispensations of his providence, acting toward his people with equity and moderation." Ellicott says a better translation of the word there than justice or judgment is righteousness. "For the Lord is a God of righteousness." In other words, it is just and right for him to show mercy because that's what he wants to do. He wants to show mercy. "Blessed are all who wait for him." Notice the wait instead of going down to Egypt and relying on the arm of the flesh and getting pagans to help you out. Wait for God. Oh, what a perfect sermon illustration that would be. Verse 19, "O people of Zion who live in Jerusalem, you will weep no more." And again, I think that's after Sennacherib leaves. They'll be saying, "Hallelujah, he's gone. How gracious he will be when you cry for help. As soon as he hears, he will answer you. Although the Lord gives you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction," that would be the siege of Jerusalem, as well as the trampling down of all the other cities of Judah by Sennacherib, "your teachers will be hidden no more." These teachers who were snuffed out by the people that said, "We don't want to hear a vision, we don't want to hear the prophets, shut up," that Isaiah has just mentioned. "Your teachers will be hidden no more." The teachers being the prophets that were trying to instruct them in the way to go. "With your own eyes you will see them," because they're not be hidden anymore. You'll see them. You'll understand what they're saying. "Whether you turn to the right or to the left, your ears will hear a voice behind you." This is an allusion to schoolmasters, most probably, who stand behind their scholars or at their backs to guide, teach, and instruct them. It seems to me this is what Isaiah is referring to because of the word teachers in verse 20. In verse 20, he says, "Your teachers will be hidden no more." And then in verse 21, he says, "There's a voice behind you." It sounds like the teacher is speaking behind the student, the person of Judah, who needs to know the word of the Lord. This voice speaking from behind, option number two, could be an allusion to shepherds following their flocks. When they observe any of the sheep going out of the way, these shepherds call the sheep back. Option number three, it could be an allusion to travelers, a person behind a traveler sees the traveler about to make the wrong turn, and this person calls to the traveler and says, "No, this is the right way to go." Other people have speculated this voice is the voice of one's conscience, or maybe the Spirit of God speaking in their ear, or maybe even the Scriptures being read to them by someone, and that would explain to them the way to go. Well, whatever that voice is, somehow God's going to communicate to his people, his repentant people, which way they should go. Oh, another good sermon application. You better listen to the voice of God if you want to know how to conduct yourself. Verse 22, "Then you will defile your idols overlaid with silver and your images covered with gold, and you will throw them away like a kotex, like a menstrual cloth." What a nasty metaphor. What a nasty image. Well, idols are nasty. You'll defile these idols, probably by filing the silver and the gold off of the underlying wood, perhaps. "And you will say to the idols, bye-bye, away with you." Now, of course, that immediately makes one think of the return from Babylon when there were no more idols because the Jews completely abandoned idolatry after their Babylonian exile. But we're taking this as the relief of the city of Jerusalem from Sennacherib's invasion in 701 during Hezekiah's reign. And we see some other scriptures that show that Hezekiah got rid of idols. He set away with them. He defiled them. 2 Kings 18:4. He, that's Hezekiah, removed the high places, shattered the sacred pillars, and cut down the Asherah poles. The Asherah poles were wooden poles dedicated to Astarte, that Lebanese fertility goddess, the consort of Baal. Hezekiah cut down those poles. He broke into pieces the bronze snake that Moses made, for the Israelites burned incense to it up to that time. He called it Nehushtan. Moses called it Nehushtan. Naturally, it wasn't an idol when Moses made it, but the people turned it into an idol, like they turned everything else into an idol. 2 Chronicles 29:16. The priest went to the entrance of the Lord's temple to cleanse it. They took all the unclean things they found in the Lord's sanctuary to the courtyard of the Lord's temple. Then the Levites received them and took them outside to the Kidron Valley. And they, of course, destroyed the idols, burned them up in the Kidron Valley. 2 Chronicles 31:1. When all this was completed, all Israel who had attended went out to the cities of Judah and broke up the sacred pillars, chopped down the Asherah poles, and tore down the high places and altars throughout Judah and Benjamin, as well as in Ephraim and Manasseh, to the last one. This again is in the times of Hezekiah. So I think that fulfills it pretty nicely. I don't think we have to refer this to the return from Babylon. Now these idols are compared to a menstrual cloth, a filthy kotex, if you will. A filthy menstrual cloth is not only filthy and loathsome, but it was actually Levitically defiling. Whoever touched a menstrual cloth was unclean by the law for a while. We read in Leviticus 15:19, when a woman has a discharge and it consists of blood from her body, she will be unclean because of her menstruation for 7 days. Everyone who touches her will be unclean until evening. This verse is not the only verse that Isaiah uses the imagery of a filthy, dirty menstrual rag. He uses it also in a more familiar verse, Isaiah 64:6. All of us have become like something unclean, and all our righteous acts are like a polluted garment. Now, polluted in the original is literally menstrual, as the Holman Christian Study Bible note tells us. So all of our righteous acts are like a menstrual rag. We go now to Isaiah 30:23-26. Isaiah continues, he will also send you rain for the seed you sow in the ground, and the food that comes from the land will be rich and plentiful. In that day your cattle will graze in broad meadows. The ox and donkeys that work the soil will eat fodder and mash spread out with fork and shovel. Such a bucolic scene. It's really interesting to me how Isaiah can preach hell, fire, and damnation and judgment, and then just on a dime switch to almost utopian scenes. Verse 25, in the day of great slaughter when the towers fall, streams of water will flow on every high mountain and every lofty hill. The moon will shine like the sun, and the sunlight will be 7 times brighter, like the light of 7 full days, when the Lord binds up the bruises of his people and heals the wounds he inflicted. Now in verse 23, Isaiah says that the food that comes from the land will be rich and plentiful at this time. As John Gill points out, after Sennacherib's army left, for years after, there was great fruitfulness in the land. We read in Isaiah 37:30 concerning this event, this exit of Sennacherib, this will be the sign for you. This year you will eat what grows on its own, and in the second year what grows from that. But in the third year sow and reap, plant vineyards and eat their fruit. Sennacherib's army kept them from planting for a while, and they had to rely on volunteer growth, but as time went on, things recovered. There were vineyards and the fruit of vineyards, and there were crops. So, food is plentiful. The cattle are grazing in broad meadows. The oxen and donkeys will eat fodder. Fodder is livestock feed, which consists especially of chopped hay or straw. And mash is instead of a mixture of straw, but a mixture of grain that's been ground. And other nutrients designed to feed livestock, as well as fowl. And the fodder and the mash is spread out with fork and shovel. That's what farmers do. Now in verse 25 it says, in the day of great slaughter when the towers fall, all these good things will happen. Well, the day of great slaughter would be when Sennacherib's army was destroyed by an angel in one night. When we get to Isaiah 37 or so, somewhere around there, we'll be talking a lot about that. Some people say this is referring to when Cyrus the Persian beat the Babylonians in 539 B.C. I do not think so. In the day of great slaughter when the towers fall. Well, as Clark and Jameson, Fawcett and Brown say, those towers probably refer figuratively to the great men and princes of the Assyrian army. That's when the towers fell. Or it could be literally a reference to fortifications which were raised in the Assyrian camp, and they fell on that night when the plague hit Sennacherib's army. Now, of course, commentators split on this. Some people say it's the towers of Babylon that fell. Again, I don't think that's what's being referred to here, but Jameson Fawcett and Brown does. Barnes says perhaps it's Babylon. Poole says, well, that's an optional choice. Poole says Babylon was famous for towers, so therefore this could be Babylon that's being talked about. In other words, after the return from Babylon to Israel in 538 or 7 B.C. Jameson Fawcett and Brown and Benson punt, and they say that all the towers stand for all the enemies of Israel. Well, that makes the prophecy sort of vague, does it not? Benson says it refers to Jerusalem in AD 70. Once again, we've gone through this exercise many times. Israel was wiped out by Assyria, by Babylon, and by the Romans. Which one is it? I always like to say it's the one that's closest to when Isaiah was prophesying, especially if you can find something that ties it down, if it's possible. In verse 26, we see that Isaiah says that the moon will shine like the sun. In other words, it'll be a lot brighter than it normally is, because the moon's never as bright as the sun. The sunlight will be a lot brighter than it usually is, because it will be shining seven times brighter. Well, that imagery of light is used by Isaiah in Isaiah chapter 60, and also John, the Apostle John, quotes Isaiah, makes an allusion to this light metaphor in Revelation 21 and 22. I'll read those verses in a minute, but first of all, what does Isaiah refer to when he says the light's brighter? I think he's merely referring to Judah after the Assyrians had left. Things are brighter. That's the simplest way to take it. But Gill and Clark take it to refer to the days of the Messiah, because the gospel is brighter than the Old Testament revelation. I'm just not that spiritual, I guess. I don't think that's what Isaiah was referring to. I think he's trying to talk about the people of Judah. Now, of course, in the New Testament, John does make allusions to that, and I do think that refers to the New Covenant. But as for the direct reference, I think it's referring to the brighter times that are occurring after Sennacherib has left. Let's read another reference to the bright sun and the bright moon. Isaiah 60 verses 19 through 20. The sun will no longer be your light by day, and the brightness of the moon will not shine on you. But the Lord will be your everlasting light, and your God will be your splendor. Your sun will no longer set, and your moon will not fade. For the Lord will be your everlasting light, and the days of your sorrow will be over. Now, of course, this is not meant to be taken literally. The sun is not going to be seven times brighter than it was before, as in Isaiah 30. And the sun will not stop setting, as in Isaiah 60. This is metaphorical language. It's referring to the fact that we don't need physical light when we have spiritual light from the Lord. Now let's look at Revelation 21, verses 23 through 24. John says, the city, that's the New Jerusalem, the church, the New Covenant church, the city does not need the sun or the moon to shine on it, because God's glory illuminates it, and its lamp is the Lamb. And I can't tell you how many dispensationalist prophecy people take this and talk about what the lighting situation is going to be in the New Jerusalem, that big square city floating up there in the sky. The book of Revelation was meant to be taken symbolically, folks. God's glory illuminates it, the New Jerusalem. Its lamp is the Lamb. See, we don't need physical light because we have spiritual light, except this is all a metaphor to show how great the spiritual light we have is. It's not meant to be talking about how much physical light we're going to have in the New Jerusalem. The nations will walk in its light, the spiritual light. Revelation 22:5, night will no longer exist and people will not need lamplight or sunlight. Really? We don't need a lamplight or sunlight in the new creation, in the new earth? Yes, we will. We'll need to be able to see. But that's not what John is talking about here. He means we don't need natural means when we have spiritual means. We've got the Lord God to give us light. At the end of verse 26, Isaiah says the Lord will bind up the bruises of his people. That's the Jews who've been whacked by the Assyrians. And God will heal the wounds he inflicted. He will heal the wounds of the Assyrian invasion, and Israel will be sitting pretty after that. Some people say the healing refers to the healing of sin at the cross. I don't think so. I think Isaiah is going to talk about that in Isaiah 51 for sure, but not here. We go now to Isaiah 30, verses 27 through 31. Now here, Isaiah is going to return to judgment, but this time it's not judgment on Judah, as in the first part of the chapter. Now it's judgment on the enemies of Judah. starting in verse 27. See, the name of the Lord comes from afar with burning anger and dense clouds of smoke. His lips are full of wrath, and his tongue is a consuming fire. His breath is like a rushing torrent rising up to the neck. He shakes the nations in the sieve of destruction. He places in the jaws of the peoples a bit that leads them astray. And you will sing as on the night you celebrate a holy festival. Your hearts will rejoice as when peoples go up with flutes to the mountain of the Lord, to the rock of Israel. The Lord will cause men to hear his majestic voice and will make them see his arm coming down with raging anger and consuming fire, with cloudburst, thunderstorm, and hail. The voice of the Lord will shatter Assyria. With his scepter he will strike them down. Now all of this, I am sure, is talking about judgment on Sennacherib's army in 701, the army which was besieging Jerusalem at the time. In verse 27, see, the name of the Lord comes. Of course, when you see name, that's the same thing as saying the person who is named. That's just the way the Jews did it. Some people say the name of the Lord refers to the angel of the Lord who came in God's name to destroy Sennacherib's army. I don't think so. We'll just take that as God himself. So God comes from afar. And of course, as I said, is to destroy the Assyrian army with burning anger, dense clouds of smoke, lips full of wrath, tongue is burning fire, breath is like a rushing torrent. Let's just stop there at 28. His breath is like a rushing torrent rising up to the neck. If you've ever been in water and watched the water rise as it comes up your body and it gets to your neck, that means you're about to drown. Frightening. John Gill says, interestingly, the only thing that was saved of Sennacherib's army was Sennacherib, the head. He did make it back to Nineveh, to Assyria. So if we applied this metaphor to him personally, or applied it to the Assyrian army, the waters rushed and drowned his whole army. Only the head of the army survived. I think that's pushing it a little far, but that's what happened. God shakes the nations in the sieve of destruction in verse 28. A sieve normally lets chaff through, leaving wheat behind, but this sieve of destruction lets everything go through, so that it's destroyed. And of course, a sieve, you have to shake the wheat to get the wheat to go into the sieve, and so the shaking is the point of the metaphor. Not really the separation out of anything, but the point is the shaking of the sieve. So the nations, that would be all those who are allied with Assyria, the Gentile peoples. Remember, Assyria had a lot of constituent nations within it, conquered nations. God places in the jaws of the peoples, that's the Assyrians, a bit that leads them astray. Sennacherib's army intended to go up to Jerusalem and sack it, but God put a bit in their mouth and led them away from Jerusalem. In verse 29, you will sing as on the night you celebrate a holy festival. John Gill says, Jewish feast always began the evening preceding, he means, and the feast were ushered in with singing songs and psalms, especially the feast of the Passover. Verse 29 continues, your hearts will rejoice as when people go up with flutes to the mountain of the Lord. The mountain of the Lord is Mount Zion where the temple is. They're going up to the temple with flutes. This is what Gill says about the flutes. Usual for persons that came from distant parts of the land to the temple to worship, to bring pipes along with them in their hands and play upon them as they were traveling, to divert them and the company that were with them. Gill cites Psalms 42 verse 4. I remember this as I pour out my heart, how I walked with many, leading the festive procession to the house of God with joyful and thankful shouts. So people came up to Jerusalem on the feast, singing and playing flutes, rejoicing. Perfect metaphor. Your hearts are going to rejoice just like that when the big bad Assyrian army has been wiped out. You're going to march up to the mountain of the Lord, to Mount Zion, to the rock of Israel, because not only is the temple there in Mount Zion, but the rock of Israel, that's Yahweh, he's often called the rock of Israel, he's there in Jerusalem too, and that's what you're marching up to. He's there at the temple, and you're marching up there to him. Verse 30, the Lord will cause men to hear his majestic voice, that voice which gave the order to the angel to destroy Sennacherib's army in one night in 701 B.C. And so men will see, namely the Assyrians, will see God's arm coming down with raging anger, consuming fire, cloudburst, thunderstorm, and hail. Of course, all those meteorological phenomena refer to God's wrath and anger. The voice of the Lord will shatter Assyria, the Assyrian army, and his scepter, he will strike them down. With his scepter, he will strike them down. A scepter is a symbol of rule. God rules. He rules the Assyrians, and he will destroy them. We go now to verses 32 and 33 of Isaiah 30, and we will finish this chapter. Every stroke the Lord lays on them, on the Assyrians, with his punishing rod will be to the music of tambourines and harps. As he fights them in battle with the blows of his arm, Topheth has long been prepared. It has been made ready for the king, that's the king of Assyria. Its fire pit has been made deep and wide with an abundance of wood. The breath of the Lord, like a stream of burning sulfur, sets it ablaze. Now, it's interesting that tambourines and harps are going to be played right when God is whacking the Assyrians with his punishing rod, the blows of his arm. Well, the tambourines and harps express the joy of God's people at the destruction of their enemies. A little bit of schadenfreude there. There's nothing wrong with rejoicing when enemies go down. Nothing. I know that there's a sort of a super spiritual idea that we should be sad when our enemies go down. What a tragedy. Oh, no. We shouldn't be sad when the devil is thrown into the lake of fire. We shouldn't be sad when the devil's allies, human allies, are thrown into the lake of fire. When Adolf Hitler's down there, I'm not sad about that. I rejoice over that. Justice has been done. People who feel sorry for demons and the Adolf Hitlers of this world do not have a proper concept of the justice of God and the evil of sin. In verse 33, Isaiah says, Topheth has been prepared for the Assyrians. What is Topheth? Well, some people say that's where the Assyrian army was actually pitched before it was destroyed. They were camped out in that valley. That's the valley of Hinnom, right south of the city of Zion, the city of David, which reaches down into the valley which is at the intersection of the Tyropean Valley on the west of the city of David and the Kidron Valley on the east of the city of David. The Hinnom Valley is right down there at the southern tip where everything comes together at a point. And this was the trash dump of Israel and also the crematorium because dead bodies were thrown in there, criminals and such, and they would burn them up and they would burn the trash there too. Nasty place. It was called Gehenna, which is, of course, the word that Jesus used for hell. It was a hell on earth. And that place was prepared for the Assyrians. And from this verse, I think people assume that the Assyrian army was actually literally placed there. Maybe not. Maybe this is just metaphorical for the fact that the Assyrian army is going to burn in hell. I don't know. Let's read what Gill says about Topheth, the place long ago appointed for the ruin of the Assyrian army, which pitched there. This was a valley near Jerusalem, the valley of the son of Hinnom, Ben-Hinnom, so called from the drums and tabrets, that's the tambourines, beat upon there to prevent parents hearing the cries of their infants offered to Molech. Into it was brought the filth and dung of the city. I forgot to mention that not only did they burn corpses there, they sacrificed children to idols. And then they would beat the tambourines to keep people from hearing the cries of the kids who were being destroyed. Gil continues, into it, the valley of Topheth, was brought the filth and dung of the city. Here malefactors were buried, it is said, and such as were condemned to burning were burned here, and such as had no burial were cast here, so that it was an image and picture of hell itself. And the word Gehenna, used for hell, comes from Gehinnom, or the valley of Hinnom. At the end of verse 33, in the middle, at least, Topheth is said to be a fire pit. Its fire pit has been made deep and wide. That, of course, is an allusion to the burning of bodies which took place in Topheth in the valley of Ben-Hinnom. And it's a reference to the burning of infants who were sacrificed to pagan gods, to Molech, in the valley of Ben-Hinnom, in the valley of Topheth. So the fire pit deep and wide, lots of fire, abundance of wood to keep the fires going. And then God adds to the fire with his breath, which is like burning sulfur, a stream of burning sulfur, setting all of the corpses and the dead babies and the dung and the refuse and the trash, God sets it all ablaze, along with the Assyrian army. And with those graphic words, we are now finished with Isaiah 30. We are now prepared to go to Isaiah 31, which I will call Woe to Those Who Go Down to Egypt. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.